The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Continuing our exploration this afternoon of the teaching on the five aggregates, and in particular, the insubstantial, empty nature of the aggregates, and the teaching expressing this through the similes. And just to this retreat seems to be turning into a five aggregates retreat. I never know what it's going to be when we get here. The five aggregates are a kind of a way of understanding the entirety of our experience. And so what we are exploring, one way we can think about it is the perspective we're exploring here is the five aggregates arising. And so what we are receiving in our mindfulness is simply these processes and experiences happening, the tumbling on of the processes of the five aggregates at work. And the framing of them, or the similes that are offered. There's three words that are used just to kind of reinforce the notion of the insubstantiality. And when I read it, the first simile, again, the foam. Suppose that this river Ganges was carrying along a great lump of foam. One with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to be void, hollow, insubstantial. So these three words, void, hollow, insubstantial. Void, empty. Now, these words are evocative more than they are technical terms in the suttas. As far as I know, the term here translated as void or empty is not the same that's used for emptiness. And so these are more kind of ordinary words that, my sense is, they're more ordinary words that evoke this sense of nothing there, or nothing truly there. So voidness, something empty, this talked about as being an empty hut. You know, this kind of word might be used there. So at something is absent. Something that we might think would be there is absent. You know, that's one word that's used here. And another, hollow. This word, tucha, also translated as empty, similar to the word translated as void or vain. Where vain, I think, means, what's the word? Not worthwhile, something like that. So hollow, again, something that doesn't have anything of meat to it, of substance to it. And the third word, often translated asara, often translated as insubstantial, something without substance. And so these five aggregates are understood as being without substance, hollow, empty. To me, they're reflective of the impermanent, unreliable nature of experience, of the aggregates, which is kind of shown to us through the conditionality, through seeing the conditionality of our experience. That as we see the conditionality of our experience, we understand it's not so much a thing there. It's not a thing that there, it's just there's this process is arising, coming into being and falling apart. And so this too points to the lack of substance of experience. That the sense that there is a substance here is kind of shown to be, or something that is inherently existing, let's say, that's another way to think of substance, something inherently existent is shown to be a misunderstanding, because we see there are conditions putting this together, putting what is seen to be a thing, putting it together. And when conditions change that, what we see, what seems to be a thing, falls apart. You know, a good example or analogy might be a rainbow. That a rainbow seems to have some kind of a thingness to it, but it also is pretty ephemeral. Maybe ephemeral is a good word here too. The rainbow arises in dependence on several conditions. There's the sun in the sky with rain falling and the position of an observer. The rain needs to be falling between the sun and the observer in such a way that it refracts the light in a certain way. If the observer's in a too high or too low position, they won't see the rainbow. If there's clouds in front of the sun, there won't be a rainbow. The water's not in the air, there won't be a rainbow. And so the rainbow seems to be, and we can take a picture of a rainbow. I mean, how more real can you get than that? But it doesn't have its own inherent existence. It's dependent on other conditions. And so this is what I understand this meaning of insubstantial, empty, in this case, to mean. Connected to this, the more foundational teaching and more, official Buddhist words, anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable, not self. Impermanent, unreliable, not self. And not self really being revealed in many ways through the conditioned nature of experience, the uncontrollable nature of experience. So, last time we talked about the similes for body and feeling, and so today we'll start with the simile for perception. Suppose that in the last month of the hot season at high noon, a shimmering mirage appears. One with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it. And it would appear to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in a mirage? So too, whatever kind of perception there is, whether past or future or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, one inspects it, ponders it, and carefully investigates it, and it would appear to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in perception? I think this notion of inspecting, pondering carefully is also useful to recognize. It's like when it's not inspected, pondered carefully, our kind of habits of mind come into play and might take it to be substantial. As with the mirage, if we're not inspecting carefully, we take it to be something that's substantial, something that's there. And so the pieces here are to recognize kind of the deluding nature, the deluding influence, or the deluding the way this particular aggregate. It's like each of these similes points to the way in which this particular aggregate is kind of confused, misunderstood, and misconstrued. So the mirage. The mirage itself. I love the similes the Buddha offers in so many different places in the suttas. He uses simile to help us understand what he's saying and to point to something underneath. It's like they're evocative for us. And they're evocative because we understand something about how what is being described in the simile functions or works. And so a mirage, what is a mirage? You know, a mirage, the classic mirage is the, as described here, at high noon, a shimmering mirage appears in the last month of the hot season. So this potentially is, you know, the drier time of year when the ground is more dry. And so my understanding is that what a mirage is, actually, I looked up mirage in Wikipedia. I just got to get a sense of how it works and what a mirage actually is. And in this case, with the reflection, and this, I think this one is referring to the kind of the classic seeing water on the surface of a desert on a very hot day. And the optics of this, and again, you can take a picture of a mirage. It's like a rainbow. It's an optical phenomenon. What's happening optically is that there are heat waves rising from the ground that are creating a kind of a disturbance in the air that makes that air function like a mirror reflecting the sky. And so what a mirage is here is a reflection of the sky on that shimmering surface, which looks like water. And it really looks like water. Pictures of mirages are so stunning in that if you've got mountains in the distance, you have the mirage there, and you see the reflection of the mountains in the mirage. It looks just like water. And so, a couple of pieces about this analogy, to unpack the analogy a bit. A mirage is a reflection of something that is there. It is a reflection of the sky. So there's some correspondence with something in the world. But that reflection is taken to be something that it is not. It's not taken as a reflection in this case. It's taken as actual water. In the commentaries, it says something like, a mirage deceives the multitudes. So it's an optical phenomenon, so it's very easy to be deceived by it. With that appearance of water, then you might, taking action on that kind of interpretation that there's water there, you might go in search of water, and then at every step you take, it keeps receding. It keeps receding, so you never get there. So the mirage is both a reflection of something that is there and is also interpreted in an unhelpful way. It is taken to be something that it is not. And so the Buddha says that perceptions are like this. Perceptions are like mirages. When delusion is functioning with perception, we tend to take perception to be something it is not. And so it is both perceptions to me. Perception is, you know, as we talked about the other day, perception is a kind of a pattern matching function. We take in sense impressions, and based on our sense impressions, our mind kind of goes and says, what is that like? Pulls something out of its filing cabinet and says, okay, this is what's being perceived. And so everything that we're seeing here, I mean, that what's coming into our eyes here is form and color, and the perception of what's out there, people, zabutons, walls, windows, that is the mind creating the recognition. And so the perception is a reflection of what's out there. I mean, what I know while I'm sitting here looking out at the room is the seeing of people and what's hard to recognize or understand is that what I'm actually experiencing is not actually you, but my mind's construction of you. That's hard to see. And so the perception, that recognition of experience as a construction of the mind, is a reflection of something that's out there. At least I believe that. I believe that you're all out there, not just sitting here and giving a Dharma talk to imagination. So there's that kind of that similarity to the mirage, that the perception is a reflection of what's out there. But then when there's confusion or delusion or not recognizing, oh, this is a reflection. And when you've got skill and being in the desert, you can probably begin to recognize, oh yeah, that's a mirage. We shouldn't like make our way that way. You know, there begins to be some wisdom about the recognition of that particular appearance. And likewise, with the perception, we can begin to recognize this is a perception. It's not reality. It's not what's actually out there. This is what's arising in the mind. And this points to really one of the key places and key ways that we get caught and begin to cling in relation to perception, is that we take what our perceptions are to be reality. We take them to be true. So this process of perception, as we explored the other day, the process of perception is really useful. It's like a shortcut in the mind to help us not have to figure out every moment of the day, you know, put together what we're experiencing. That's a door. I walk through the door. I don't walk through the wall. Finding our way, navigating our way through the world. Perception helps us do that without becoming exhausted in a way. And yet we're not recognizing that it is perception. And without that recognition, so perception's very useful, but it also is very easily co-opted by delusion. Delusion co-opts perception and has us believing that what we are perceiving is what's actually out there. But given that what we are actually experiencing, what our experience actually is not what's out there, but constructed by our own minds. Given that what we are experiencing is constructed by our minds, there's a lot of room for misinterpretation to come in. The different ways this happens. One way this happens is that the perceptions themselves, what we perceive as we go through our day, is pre-influenced. Let's say, I mean, it's not simply that we're like, I think I said the other day, not like just cameras and microphones picking up the actuality of experience. We are perceiving Our perceptions are shaped by our views, our beliefs, our ideas, our opinions. So when I was about 6, I was in school and we had a teacher who was teaching us how to draw fruits and vegetables. And she had a kind of a good way to help us do that in terms of seeing the color and the different shades of color and how if we change the shade of the color. It was very cool, actually. You know, us 5-year-olds created pretty good looking apples on drawings. They were pretty realistic looking because she had taught us how to use the shadings of the colors and the, you know, the light, you know, a little patch of white in there. So to actually begin to see the color piece and transfer that into the drawing. So she was really helpful with helping us see the color aspect of what we were looking at. She was less good at helping us with the form aspect because we would draw our circles for the apples and some of us would like draw these wobbly circles and she'd come around and make us erase them and draw like a perfect circle. And she said, apples are perfectly round. And we were looking at the apples and thinking, I don't think so. Apples are not lopsided, she said. Apples are not lopsided. And so one day one of the students brought in, you know, sometimes you had these apples that are like, you know, it's like really the stem parts over here and you got this big section over here and a little section over here. Somebody brought in one of those apples and put it on her desk. And she did not say a word. So I don't know what was going on with my teacher about the form of the apple, but every now and then as I went through my life, I wondered about this. It's like, how could she not see that apples can be lopsided? And one day I was cutting an apple, and I tend to cut my apples on the line of symmetry. You know, there's a kind of a line through the apple where if you cut it, it falls into mirror images. And at some point I was doing that and appreciating the mirror image through this lopsided apple. And I kind of had this flash about my teacher. And I thought, I wonder if, so this is speculation, but you know, it's possible. I wonder if somebody told her in some biology class somewhere that the growth pattern of apples creates symmetrical apples. Meaning, you know, the two mirror images when you cut it. And she misinterpreted symmetry to mean perfection of, you know, completely perfectly shaped. So her inability to see the imperfectly shaped apples, possibly influenced by a view, a belief, an idea. Somebody told her something, a teacher that she believed told her this information, misunderstood what he told her, she told her, whatever, what that teacher told her, misunderstood that, and then perceived or misperceived experience from there. And so our perceptions, you know, how we perceive experience, we can't just completely mistake our experience based on our views, our beliefs, our agendas. So this is one way in which delusion operates with respect to perception. One way that kind of view or the deluding influence of the mind co-opts perception. And so we don't perceive things as they are. One famous from Anais Nin. We don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. Really speaking to that, views, opinions, beliefs, influencing how we meet the world. So that's one way, you know, that we are predisposed to perceive experience in a certain way. If we don't know this, we can get into trouble. Taking our perceptions to be truth. Then another way we kind of get into trouble with perceptions is that believing them to be true, and this is, I think, essentially here, this is really pointing to that, taking that mirage to be water. You know, here we are, we're in the desert, we see this mirage, we take it to be water, we are heading for that water, we're thirsty, we want to drink that water. And so we're taking action based on the belief that it is real, that this is an actuality. This is also the nature of perception. We perceive something, take it to be truth, take it to be the actuality, and then act based on that belief. And so it's not the perception itself that creates the problems really here. It's the belief, the view that is associated with that. And it can be at a very like foundational level, just simply the belief that what I'm perceiving is actuality. This is what's there. So the classic story of the blind people and the elephant is kind of a good analogy or simile for this. It's the blind people touching various pieces of the elephant, some touching the legs, some the trunk, some the tusks, some the tail, and then asked, what is an elephant like with each one? You know, they're told, basically. So to me, this story is a little bit sneaky. You know, it's like they were, the people who were showing the blind people the elephant were being a little bit deceptive, because one of the blind people, this is the elephant, the leg, and another, this is the elephant touching the tusk. And so they were told, this is the elephant, and touching a particular part of the elephant. And then when asked, what is an elephant, they would say they're different. An elephant is like a post, an elephant is like a hose, an elephant is like a side of a storeroom, an elephant is like a broom. So all these different associations or perceptions based on what they had touched. And then the story goes on that they came to blows, arguing, you're wrong. An elephant is not like that. An elephant is like this. I felt it with my own hands. You are wrong. And so this is another piece of the delusion around perception. When we take perceptions to be truth, the reification or the kind of solidifying, this is what that is, then we may not recognize, as in this example, that, you know, to say this part of the elephant is like a post is not incorrect. But to exclude the possibility that another part of the elephant has a completely different nature is a misperception, is not understanding something, a bigger picture. And I think this kind of thing happens a lot to us. And in particular, you know, it's like when we experience something with our own eyes, our own senses, it can get very strongly reified. It's like, no, that is what I experienced. Somebody else says something else happened there. And it's like, well, I didn't see that. I would have seen that. So it didn't happen. So this creates a lot of conflict in culture, in society, in relationship with each other, this reification around perception. And it comes out of that very simple kind of misunderstanding of what I perceive is reality. And so the clinging or the kind of suffering that arises as a result of this. I mean, it's very interesting to kind of begin to explore the connection with that deluding aspect of perception and how suffering happens. And one of the ways to reflect on this, I mean, the perception, what we are experiencing, everything we're experiencing is a construct of the mind. We're not experiencing anything outside of our mind's creation. It's a reflection. Again, it's like the mirage. It's a reflection of what's out there. But everything is a creation of our minds. Everything that we are experiencing is a creation of our minds. This experience of contacting the table, the hardness, the pressure, that's not in the table. That's a construct of my mind, of the sense base plus the body and the mind, putting that together. And so all experience constructed in the mind, constructed by the mind. And so when craving happens, you know, craving, wanting something, wanting to hold on to something, wanting to have something, wanting to get rid of something. You know, that part too, the craving is a function of the mind. That's happening in the mind. The leaning towards, the leaning away from, the desire for. So suffering is created by this kind of leaning towards, pulling away from, a desire to hold on to things that are slipping away, that are unreliable, impermanent. So there's that. The suffering is created by the craving, and the craving is a mental phenomenon. But what does that craving actually want? You know, what it wants, what it only thing it can want, the only thing it has any access to, the only thing we have any access to and experience is a construct of our minds. And so that craving, what that craving wants is not actually something that's out there. But we are craving something that our mind created. We are craving that mirage. That's like the frustration that would result from seeing it just keep recede, right? It's like, you know, believing, no, it's really there. I just haven't quite gotten there yet. It's really there. I just need to go a little further. I'll get to that water. It's kind of like that. It's that mirage is a construction. It's not, we're never going to reach it. Likewise with the craving, we are craving what is constructed by our minds. It's not, we're not actually craving what's out there. And our minds begin to see this. In observing our experience, our minds begin to recognize not only is the craving something that the mind is producing, but also what it craves is something constructed by the mind. At one point, I saw this. I saw how I was craving a lot. I was craving hearing descriptions of meditative experiences in the hall, you know, on a 3-month course, and hearing descriptions of certain kind of meditative experiences. And boy, so much craving around wanting those experiences, wanting to have those. And I spent a lot of time feeling the craving, feeling the kind of pull to that, and knowing that it was craving, knowing that it was just like, yep, that's craving. But it wasn't until I really began to look at what I craved and what that was, that things really started to like shift. And it's like, whoa, that's pretty bizarre. Because at one point I began to notice when that craving was happening, what was going on in the mind was an imagination of sitting in the room with the interview teacher, telling the teacher that I'd had this experience. And, you know, having that teacher, like, you know, say nice things about my meditation and feeling really good about me being a meditator and figuring things out. And so that was was what I craved. It was a construct of the mind. I had no idea what that meditative experience was. I couldn't even possibly like really crave that thing because I'd never experienced it before. But what I craved was an idea of telling my teacher this. And when I saw that, it's just like, wow, that is just a complete figment of the mind. It's an imagination. That craving is about something that's non-existent. And when the mind begins to understand that, well, not only is this craving something that the mind is participating in, that it's kind of whipping up, but also what it craves is something the mind has whipped up. The mind just like realizes, wow, what a futile project this craving is. And begins to let it go. So the next one, mental formations. I love this analogy too. I love all these analogies. Suppose that that one needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, would take a sharp axe and enter a forest. There they would see the trunk of a large plantain tree, which is basically a banana tree. Straight, fresh, without a fruit bud core. They would cut it down at the root, cut off the crown, and unroll the coil. As they unroll the coil, they would not find even soft wood, let alone hardwood. One with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in the trunk of a plantain tree? So, too, whatever kind of volitional formations there are, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, one inspects them, ponders them, and carefully investigates them. As they are investigated, they appear to be void, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in volitional formations? So, first, just a little about the word volitional formations, what that is. So, volitional formations are, again, we've talked about this a few days ago, but just a reminder, the many mental activities that involve intention, volition, choice, not necessarily a conscious volition or intention, but that essentially they are actors in our minds. They are agents. They have an agency. They have a job. So this includes the many emotional states: anger, frustration, confusion, irritation, pride, conceit, boredom, as well as mind states like love, compassion, mindfulness, concentration. These are all in this realm of volitional formations. And then also beliefs, thoughts. Views, agendas, also in this realm of volitional formations. So there are many mental activities that involve some aspect of volition, of agency. And this agency piece is a little hard potentially to connect to, when it's not us doing it. But we can begin to understand this, them as the shapers of experience. So I'm just going to leave that there for now, come back to it in a minute, and go back to the analogy and unpack this analogy a little bit. So I was in the Peace Corps in the late 90s and lived in a South Pacific island where they had many plantain trees. So I got familiar with plantain trees. This analogy may not have a lot of resonance for those of us who haven't had direct exposure to plantain trees and what happens around plantain trees. I mean, when you plantain trees, the banana trees are used for many purposes, not just for the bananas. The leaves are used for carrying things. You know, they're used for packaging things. They're used for cooking. And so the leaves are well a part of the functional use of this banana tree. And so often, you know, usually they cut down the banana tree after it has produced the bananas. But in this case, it's pretty explicit. Cutting down a tree without a fruit bud core, so cutting down a tree before it has the fruit, because when the tree has the fruit, it produces a kind of a soft, like, pith in the middle that maybe does some nourishment or produces some nourishment for the fruit. But in any case, so very often these banana trees are cut down with the purpose of using the leaves. And so you have this tree, and they're hard, you know, they're big, that the trunks of those trees can be 6-8 inches across. Very solid looking tree. You can lean on it. You know, it's got a solidity to it. Feels hard. After you cut it down, and I saw this so many times, the taking apart of the banana leaves. So each banana leaf has got a big kind of leafy part at the top, and then it's got a kind of stiff, hard part at the bottom. Maybe this, we could call it the stem of the leaf. And it's kind of got a curved shape to it, long, and it's got a broad part at the bottom. And these stems overlap one on top of another, on top of another, on top of another. And the stems are stiff. And so that is the structure of the banana tree, these stems just laid on top of each other. And when you take the banana tree down in order to use the leaves, you start unrolling it. It's like you've got, it's just, they're layered, and you can just like peel one off, kind of like celery, you know, you peel one piece of celery, you peel the outermost celery off, and then you get down to the next one and the next one, and you just keep peeling off the leaves. And there's a pile of leaves in front of you at the end. And that's it. There's a pile of leaves in front of you. There's nothing else there. It's just a pile of leaves. There's no solidity. There's no heartwood. Nothing in the middle of that tree that is stable or solid there. It's the solidity, and this is part of the reason I really like this. The solidity is composed of this kind of layering. And the firmness of that is composed of the layering of those stems. So the apparent hardness of the tree is made up of a whole bunch of layers. To me, this seems so appropriate or apropos of our emotional responses and how solid they seem sometimes. And we start to look at our mental formations, our reactivity, our moods and emotions, and so much in particular when we're suffering, you know, it's like when we are taking some particular reactivity to be me or mine and really taking it as solid, often what's going on there is it's not just one simple like mental formation. It's a whole host of mental formations propping each other up, beliefs, emotions, views, thoughts, all kind of weaving together, all like supporting each other, creating this sense of solidity. And, you know, the instruction, one inspects it, ponders it, observes, observing our mental formations, observing that, we start to see. And sometimes in the observation of our dukkha, mental reactivity around certain things, I encourage people to really take a wide stance, you know, not to try to dig. You know, it's actually not so helpful to, you know, the analogy of unrolling the coil is useful to help us understand that it is composed of many different layers. And yet, digging in and trying to figure out what's in the middle or what all the layers are in terms of our mental formations is often not so helpful. But more just kind of settle back and let the various pieces of the reactivity just begin to reveal themselves as we sit there with some challenging experience. We might see the whiff of a thought and then the feeling of a contraction of an irritation and then the feeling of a frustration and then an idea, belief they should have, and see all these little like pieces come in as aspects or components of that, and begin to see that, you know, they're propping each other up. They're creating that solidity. They're creating that sense of solidity. And so we begin to see also here this conditioned nature around mental formations, how the views and ideas affect the emotions and how the emotions affect the body, and so this all of this interweaving conditionality with the mental formations. And this is an important piece of the understanding around seeing the mental formations, is the word for mental formations. And mental formations, volitional formations, different translations of the same term. I'm responding a little bit to a question somebody had about volitional formations and mental formations here. Same word in the Pali, different translations, getting at some slightly different potentially qualities of the experience. The Pali itself, Sankara, has two flavors to it. It has like a double meaning to it. It both means that which has been put together. So the banana tree, you know, the whole complex of reactivity there, that the love, the confusion, the anger, the irritation, those are the mental formations, are the volitional formations. So they are formed, they're formed in the mind. So mental formations is possibly a word to kind of connect with that side of it, what has been put together, and they are constructed out of experience, conditioned based on our experience. Anger arises in dependence on views and contact of some sight, perhaps, and some belief that comes along. And so, you know, we start to see how that it is constructed. And what we see is this mental formation. We begin to recognize, okay, this is the experience of anger. And that's noticing, being with that mental formation, being with that experience, knowing it. The other side of that word, the kind of the flip side of the word, or the other meaning of the word, is that which puts together. So it has a double meaning. It's not only that which has been put together, it is that which puts together. So it's the process. The mental formations are the processes of conditionality. They shape our experience. And it is in this way that they are called volitional or intentional formations. We could call them shaping formations. It's that shaping aspect that is this kind of connection with the volitional aspect. This is the agency. Their job is to shape. So the job of anger is to shape our experience in terms of anger. Wanting to get rid of something, separate from something, wanting to fix or change something. It also shapes feeling. It shapes the experience primarily as unpleasant. It shapes perceptions in line with that view that there's something to be angry about. It shapes our body, the impact of that emotion on our body has an effect, creates pressure, heat, maybe even distorts our face. I went through this the other day. So the volitional formation, it's volitional in that it shapes, it has an agency. It's not necessarily us consciously doing it. When we get angry, we don't think, oh, I'm going to distort my face. Anger is doing that. And so it's got that agency. It's got that, Sayadaw sometimes calls it the job description. And he encourages us at times, get to know the job description of your mental events, of the mental phenomenon at work in the mind. Get to know the job description of greed. Get to know the job description of aversion. Get to know the job description of love and mindfulness. What are the functions of these? And that begins to, again, it points to the job description. You know, if you think of what a job description is, it's like, this is what you're supposed to do. You know, you get a piece of paper that tells your job to the Sangha service jobs, right? You know, you've got your job description. These are your actions. This is what you do. This is how you do this job. And so likewise, our mental formations, you know, kind of have this job. You know, the job of anger, the job of aversion is to believe that separating from something is going to make you happy. And so it shapes everything in terms of that, like, goal. It's not personal. It's just the job of anger, the job of aversion. So this shaping quality, this is basically the engine of conditionality. These mental formations are the engine of conditionality. And seeing how, in particular, not only emotions, but at a deeper level, some of the deepest kind of shapers are beliefs and views. Views of who we are, what we're capable of, who other people are, what they're supposed to do. Views about reality being there should be, or kind of the perspective that, you know, that there should be stable, reliable experience out there. And if I can't find it, it means I'm failing. So the views and beliefs are a very powerful shaper of our experience. And as I pointed to and this kind of ties back in a way to the elephant story, you know, that our views are shaped by what we experience. And those views that come out of our direct experience are really powerful. Actually, I've read a lot about the nature of views recently, the kind of the way in which confirmation bias is the name of it that's being talked about a lot these days, that when we hold a view, we tend to seek information that confirms it and to not take in or acknowledge information that disconfirms it. Actually, in fact, people have done studies that if you have a bias towards something and somebody tells you something that disconfirms it, people can even entrench further into their own view rather than it actually being taken in. They come up with some reason why you might be lying, or some reason why it's you're seeing it wrong or whatever. So, you know, it's like that being approached with evidence to the contrary doesn't necessarily undo confirmation bias, especially when we have some foundation from our own experience. But also, I've heard, you know, some studies have been done around just a view that's created through reading a story, a simple story about, well, I won't try to describe the story because I don't have time, but just reading a simple story, there was a study done where they constructed either one view or another view based upon a simple story. And then they were told afterwards that that was just a story and that it had no basis in reality. And then later they were asked something that kind of got at, did they have any lingering views that were based on that initial story that they were told, which they were later told was false. So a view was seeded. They were told it was false. And this is like some trivial thing, you know, some view that isn't something they would have necessarily carried initially, told it was not true. And then later asked their opinion about something that was connected to that view. And by the vast majority had been influenced by that, by being told something by somebody else, not even from their own direct experience. So the first time we're told something also has a pretty powerful effect on our views, holding on to those views, even if we're told, oh, sorry, I made a mistake. Didn't mean that. Having heard something, even just once, can condition a strong view. And so much suffering comes from this, holding on to views and beliefs that are basically just, you know, constructed out of somebody's ideas or opinions, and some of out of our own direct experience. And the Buddha actually points to this in one text. You know, we experience things so much more clearly and directly in meditation, right? And so that seems really trustable and reliable, what I've experienced in meditation. And yet the Buddha actually cautions us about views created, about views that happen as a result of meditation experience. He said, some of those are the stickiest views there are. Some of the most hard to see as views. And so we also need to take care with views around the Dharma. And I mentioned this the other day in terms of, you know, the Buddha pointed to not clinging even to the Dharma, not clinging to wholesome states, not clinging to the Dharma. That we make use of the Dharma to help us understand how to let go. I think I said this the other day, the view, one of the views, way we could express the view of the Dharma is it's a view that helps us to see that views create suffering. Holding to views, clinging to views creates suffering. So that view kind of creates the conditions of its own release. Because if we cling to that view, the whole notion of that view tells us, yeah, even clinging to that view is going to be suffering. And so this is a major way to see, you know, the empty nature of our mental formations is the conditioned nature. It's nothing stable. There's no heartwood there. It's layers of experience on top of each other, creating a sense of stability or solidity. But no solidity actually there. And then the other piece of it, the constructing nature, not seeing our minds as constructors, not knowing that, not understanding that, not understanding that those constructions are simply coming into being and falling apart, coming into being and falling apart, insubstantial. Perception in the mental formations kind of play here, in that when we perceive something, so that kind of reification process of taking that perception to be what's there, we perceive our mental formations and we take them to be solid and real. Seeing their constructed nature helps us to recognize that that is a kind of an overlay, that solidity is an overlay, a misperception. And so, to be continued, there's one more analogy. We'll get that one next time. So let's sit for just a moment.